Hi, you're listening to a podcast of the best bits of Breakfasters for the week ending Friday the 11th of July. We're on Triple R every weekday morning from 6 till 9 a.m, broadcast live from Melbourne, Wurundjeri Country, Australia. Coming up on this podcast, you'll hear Press Colours' Sam Cummins pop in to talk AI bans and Spotify boycotts, and Evelyn Araluen chats about Generations of Story taking place at Namangari Library for NAIDOC Week.
Vanessa Toholka gave us the mood check on vibe coding, and we try to get into the minds of whoever stole Joe Camilleri's 9 guitars. If you're listening, please return them.
Best-selling author Mark Brandy divulges the storytelling secrets behind his new crime thriller Eden, and Friday funny bugger Oliver Coleman runs us through his latest list of reasons to be cheerful.
Independently yours, Triple R.
102.7.
Fresh off the back of his Press Colour Centennial, what a treat to have with us Sam Cummins. Good morning, Sam.
Good morning. Yeah, Centennial sounds impressive until Denise Highlands comes in and says, hold my beer, son.
Yeah.
I've been here for at least 1,000. But thank you.
Pleasure. Now, you're taking us back into the weeds of weird dystopian music.
Yes, I'm here for another update on the front lines of, the capitalist hellscape that is the music industry. I was here recently chatting to you guys about, the AI slop that was populating a lot of artist pages on streaming. So we were talking about the story around the Sweden after the Melbourne band who had a bunch of sort of AI music populating their pages. And there's a postscript happening to that conversation at the moment. There are a lot of boycotts to the streaming platform that is Spotify happening at the moment, which is a conversation that I think has been happening for a long time. I think you'll remember that both Neil Young and Joni Mitchell boycotted the platform a couple of years ago, kind of at the height of COVID, when Spotify did a deal with Joe Rogan, and they had concerns around some of the misinformation he was spreading around vaccines and COVID. And so, yeah, Neil Young and Joni Mitchell both boycotted the platforms and removed their own music from the platforms a few years ago. But a few more boycotts have happened in sort of recent weeks, I suppose. You might have seen a couple of viral posts that have gone around on the internet. So the band Deerhoof has decided to remove their music from Spotify, and a few local artists as well. So Leah Senior and Dr. Shaw's Unusual Practice have sort of posted online to say that they are also removing their music from the platform. And I suppose they're doing so for a couple of reasons. The main one, I think, that people are citing, which I think is really the straw that has broken the camel's back here, is that you would have seen that Spotify CEO Daniel Ek has decided to invest $700 million into a company called Helsing, which is a company which develops AI software to enhance military weapons and other equipment, which is quite frightening.
That's crazy.
It is crazy, isn't it? I mean, we're just trying to,
You can't fight progress, Sam.
Yeah, you really can't. I mean, I'm just trying to jam out to the Beach Boys. And here I am.
Pay tribute to Brian Wilson, yeah, and then confronted with this.
I know. Now I'm complicit in funding, AI weapons around the world. So it's a concerning development, and I suppose it's fair enough that people have decided to leave the platform as a result of this.
I wonder, because I guess... maybe going back a couple of steps, even when Spotify started sponsoring Barcelona, or like buying shares in Barcelona, it's millions of dollars, and artists aren't exactly getting paid wads of cash.
Yeah.
Sponsoring a football team's one thing, and which is kind of unnerving, but then what?
I know, and it's such a Pandora's box of morals, isn't it? Because I feel like there is no ethical consumption under capitalism. And I suppose a lot of these people, ironically, are talking about this stuff on platforms like Meta and X. And of course, they have their own issues surrounding them as well. But I do think that, as I said, it is the straw that has broken the camel's back for musicians, especially because they're just trying to create their music and put their music out there. And now all of a sudden they're complicit in this awful thing. So that's the kind of big story, I think. And that's the reason that artists like Deerhoof and Leah Senior are citing as to why they're leaving the platform. But another story has developed this week around streaming and AI that has also caused huge backlash, which I don't know if you've seen this, but there's been the emergence of this band called the Velvet Sundown, which is a band that didn't seem to exist more than 2 months ago. There's no digital footprint of this band on the internet anywhere, but all of a sudden they've released 2 albums on streaming, and all of a sudden they have about 1 million monthly streams attributed to their name. And so something seems a bit fishy about this band, and people started doing some digging. I mean, you don't have to dig very far to realize that there's something very fishy about this band. You look at the press images of the Velvet Sundown, and it's quite clear that this band is a fake band. It is an AI band. You know, they have the sort of amber hue, glow, I suppose, of the images on their press photos and stuff, and their fingers don't look quite right. And if you listen to the music, it's this very generic kind of milquetoast version of a kind of 70s soft rocks, folk rock sound that I guess sounds a little bit like it could be a real band, but if you dig deep enough, you realize it's a fake band and an AI band. So that band is now being populated on some really popular playlists and getting some pretty serious streams.
I wonder. I need to be fact checked here. Someone should jump in and correct me. But I think the royalty rates, 1 million streams gets you about $4,000.
Okay.
So if you have $4,000, like how much would it cost to put to create this band in AI? Probably less than that. So you're probably making money.
Yeah, that's right. And their streams are just growing by the day. If you look at the sorts of playlists that this band exists on, one of them is a Vietnam War protest music playlist, which has about 700,000 followers. And if you go through it, it does have some legitimate sort of anti-war songs on it. There's songs like Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, Rolling Stones' Gimme Shelter, and also the Velvet Sundown smash hit, The Wind Still Knows Our Name. And also another smash hit of theirs called Back Home Never Came, which are two completely ChatGPT song titles. I mean, I feel like it's the most sort of generic song titles you can imagine. But these songs are existing alongside real songs, and someone is truly obviously trying to trick people into thinking that this band was somehow part of the Vietnam anti-war protests back in the day.
So who is behind the band? Do we know?
Well, this is where the plot thickens, right? And where reality just continues to distort, because a few days ago, someone purporting to be a spokesperson for the band was interviewed by Rolling Stone and a few other reputable music publications, basically pushing back on the idea that the band was AI. So this person is quoted as saying, "It's absolutely crazy that so-called journalists keep pushing the lazy, baseless theory that the Velvet Sundown is AI-generated with zero evidence. This is our music, written in long, sweaty nights in cramped bungalows in California with real instruments, real minds, and real soul."
I mean, straight out of ChatGPT.
Exactly. But then the plot thickened further, because what happened was that the approved social media pages for the Velvet Sundown started to push back on the idea that that person was their spokesperson. So the fake AI band was claiming that there was someone else pretending to be the spokesperson for the band. And so now they have admitted that they are AI, and they've changed their bio on Spotify and other streaming services. So now the Velvet Sundown claim that they're a synthetic music project guided by human creative direction and composed voice and visualized with the support of artificial intelligence.
Makes you yearn for the authenticity of the Monkees.
Yeah, doesn't it? I know. Well, it's just hard to know what's real, because Rolling Stone genuinely did pick up this story and started to quote this person that was has since come out and said that he was pretending to be the spokesperson, and he was sort of just enjoying the fact that reality was being distorted in this way.
Just partaking.
Well, I mean, Neil Young's back.
Neil Young is back, yes. Mm.
And so how is this a groundswell, or is this just a little blip on the radar?
Well, that's right. I mean, if Neil Young's not going to kind of move the dial, and no disrespect to Deer Hoof, one of my favourite bands, I'm not sure if they're going to move the dial either. So I think if there were to be some serious movement in these spaces, I think like a coordinated boycott would probably need to occur. But I do think that the more this stuff pops up, the more average users are going to move away from these platforms as well. I know, I'm sure many of your friends are moving away from these platforms as well. I know a lot of people I know are, and I think that conversation is just clearly going to continue to happen as these things continue to emerge. I mean, this is not going away, right?
What are the alternative streaming services coming up? Like, surely people would be seeing this as an opportunity?
Yeah, I think so. Well, a lot of people are moving over to places like Tidal and Apple Music. I know Tidal's, the actual quality of the music being streamed there is a lot better than Spotify. But again, these are multinational conglomerates in their own right as well. And so, like I said, it's hard to know if there is any ethical consumption under capitalism. I still always talk about, you know, Bandcamp as being a great platform where you can directly engage with artists. So if you are using these streaming platforms and feeling a little bit icky about it, then I would just encourage people to go to places like Bandcamp, buy their music direct, or go to people's shows, pay for tickets, and then buy people's merch at shows.
How many streams of, well, A, did their prolific output means, well, what does that portend? How fast music can be made in this AI era?
Well, that's right. I know. And how can real humans compete with it? That's the thing. Already, the Velvet Sundown, I looked this morning, they have a new album ready to drop next week. So they're going to have three albums out in the space of 3 months. And I imagine their streams are just going to continue to go up. So, yeah, how do you compete with that?
I wonder, the interesting bit about Spotify is that when it first started, they needed buy-in from artists. And so artists had shares. I think Merlin, the Global Independent Label Association, kind of organized it. And then there was a buyout. So at one point, I remember some of the bands I was working with at the time, they got a buyout. Their shares were sold and, yeah, they got a little bit of money. But essentially, the artist gave up control. So I wonder if there's a way to flip the script, start another, like start fresh, do the same thing again, or yeah.
Yeah, I don't have the answers, Jace. I feel like you would have them more than I do, but
we'll take that as a comment.
Well, it's a pondering.
Yeah. Indeed.
I look forward to the Velvet Sundown headlining Glastonbury next year.
I mean, it's only a matter of time.
Exactly. Get Boston Dynamics involved. It's unbelievable. And it doesn't portend well for my regard for my fellow citizens and their music consumption.
No, not at all. Good luck out there, folks.
Exactly. Catch you on Press Car on Saturday. Thanks, Sam.
Triple R on FM, digital, online, via the app.
Evelyn Araluen is co-editor of Overland Literary Journal, a lecturer in Indigenous Arts and Culture at the Victorian College of the Arts, co-convening editor of the Journal of Postcolonial Studies and poet whose debut and self-described weird little pink book, Drop Bear, has sold over 25,000 copies and won the Stella Prize for Australian Women's Literature, and whose next collection, The Rot, is due out later this year. Evelyn is appearing in the upcoming event, Generations of Story, at Nam Nagar Library as part of NAIDOC Week, where three generations of Victorian Aboriginal storytellers are set to share words and reflections on their creative practices. And to tell us about it, the acclaimed writer and educator joins us now. Evelyn, welcome back to Breakfasters.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for coming in.
Now, I'm excited about The Rot. It sounds extremely powerful.
It's terrifying. Listen, for listeners at home, I've arrived a little bit late, mostly just because of the disruption to my sleep schedule of trying to finish this damn book.
Really?
It's ruining my life.
Oh.
Yeah, I love poetry so much, except when I'm writing. And everything else in my life just absolutely dissolves around that.
Am I right in thinking you didn't anticipate writing this? It kind of...
No, absolutely not. And I'm pretty sure it was in this room as well that I was just like, I'll never write poetry again. I'm done. And, yeah, and I don't know what I've cornered myself into now.
So what happened? What inspired you?
Honestly, my best friend, Chloe Mills, who then became my publicist, harassed me and bullied me into writing this book. I was, like, writing a few little things here and there, and she's like, you know what? I think you could really turn this into something new. And, yeah, now I hate her because of that.
Great. That's how all great poetry is born, through bullying. And
it sounds like it packs a punch. It dramatises the bad faiths and strategic objections of the sad girl aesthetic, romancing the lost and unfulfilled dreams of girlhood under terminal stage capitalism.
Yeah, it's really chirpy. So it's a really happy book. No, like, honestly, I think we just sort of got to this scale of trying to survive, you know, witnessing genocide and feeling, you know, simultaneously, like, really strengthened in resolve and community, and, you know, the resistance and protests that have been going on in Australia have just been such a source of, like, stubborn energy for me. And then at the same time, like, you're witnessing your world dissolve, and you know, any sense of morality you might have clung to is just turning into, like, AI slot machine, billionaire, techno-feudal decay at the end of the world. So I don't know. I've just been writing about kind of like the misery and refusal of that, and it's supposedly going to be a book. I mean, the tracked changes situation that I'm witnessing in my documents at the moment is hectic. So it might get there, and it might take me with it.
Oh, amazing. Well, does it touch on or dovetail with the event that's coming up?
Yeah, so it's, I guess, part of like the broader work that this event coming up is in the ecology of. So, you know, I've been living down here in Nam for a couple of years now and trying to do my best about like being a responsible guest in this community. You know, when you're an Aboriginal person from another nation, you're coming into a space, you know, you've got to be conscious of the way that you're supporting and uplifting and building up the traditional owners and the community members there. So, you know, I think about that creatively, and I think about how I try to do that in honouring this country here in my writing work. But I did have an opportunity through the really deadly crew at the library who were like, hey, you know, do you want to put something on? Like, you can do a poetry event, you can do something if you want. And I was like, actually, no, I would really just love to create an opportunity to hear about some of these different legacies and this intergenerational storytelling tradition that I've just got this incredible, you know, privilege to be a witness to. So, you know, they gave me the control to just call up a bunch of random people and just be like, hello, can I bully you into doing this? It's a bullying ecology in the arts, frankly. So, yeah, we've got some incredible speakers, Nawi and Annie Carolyn Briggs, Tiriki Onus and Isabella Eichler Onus. So these wow. three generations and different practices of storytelling rooted in Victorian Aboriginal community. And, like, I'm only facilitating because I want to hear this conversation. I'm a fly on the wall in this.
Triple R.
Vanessa Tolker's here to get us into a tech mood. Morning, Vanessa.
Good morning, breakfasters. How are you?
Oh, wow.
It's all about the vibe this morning. Mm-hmm. And I thought I'd come in and talk about vibe coding. Have you heard of it?
No.
No? No.
No, I've heard of Learn to Code. Yeah. I've heard of Learn to Vibe Code.
Excellent, excellent. All right. So imagine that you want to solve a problem and you're like, oh, I wish I had those software development skills, but you don't. But now that Gen AI is around, you're like, oh, gee, I wonder how far that could get me. And just by describing what you want, you don't have to create any code. Like, the system will do it for you.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
So that is the promise and the challenge of vibe coding.
Okay.
And it's potentially, like, the most fun little expression that's come around since surfing the web. But I would suggest it's similarly overinflated.
Yeah.
It did. The term was coined by Canadian machine learning researcher Andre Karpathy in February this year. So this is fresh.
It's a newie.
It is very fresh. And the idea is that instead of writing every line of code manually, developers just describe what they want in plain language and AI tools generate the code. Now, it's obviously a lot more complicated than that. In the spirit of vibe coding, there's all these sort of behaviours tied up in that, and they include accepting every suggestion that a generative AI tool might make. Like, you know, I've done this, you know, do you like that? And you're like, sure, great, add that feature, what have you. And it's learning from, you know, indicative examples all around the world. But it's incredibly different from traditional coding. So as you can imagine, coding's expensive. It's hard to get those skills, and then it's often difficult to actually fully understand a problem, dig into it, speak to users instead of just being sort of arrogant and thinking that you understand the problem deeply. You know, so there's a whole ethos, a whole professional lot of skills built up around how software is developed. And normally, in a decent scale of problem solving, that involves business analysts who are the interface and translator between users and developers. And what they do is they help understand the requirements and they translate those into product specifications, which are then, you know, and they might do wireframing and prototyping and, you know, to test these ideas with users before you go off and do the expensive software development and the build.
lots of different skill sets.
So many skill sets. And that involves breaking things down into lots of different pieces. So you sort of build and test, and then there's quality assurance, you know, to make sure that you're getting this right if you're going to use these expensive skills to do that.
Can I ask a dumb question?
Sure.
Is coding just what's under the hood of a digital
Absolutely.
App?
Right, okay. Absolutely. And there's a few different, there's a lot of nuances around that as well. There's like scripting languages, which might be things that power sort of the front end of your websites, for example. And they might be things that people have been exposed to in a school project if they've done that sort of subject. And then there's, you know, much more complex languages as well that require compiling before they're deployed into software applications. So when you look at, say, an application in the Microsoft suite, you know, that's something that is coded at a deeper level than scripting, and it's compiled into this whole package and then it's deployed. Mm-hmm. And they have version control over things like that, you know. So there's a whole lot going into it.
I was caught up with a friend recently, and I was like, he is from film and like he's very tech savvy, like post production. But I was like, he's kind of stepped away from that. And I think what he's doing now is, I don't know if it's vibe coding, but he's essentially, described this, I guess, using AI to code.
Well, there are some amazing things about it, but I don't want to overinflate the promise.
Yes, great.
So let's talk about maybe the difference in vibe coding and traditional coding. So in the approach, vibe coding, you're describing goals in plain language and just letting AI write the code. Traditional coding, you'd manually write and debug and optimize every line. With the speed, you can really quickly get a prototype, a working example of what you imagined in hours or days with vibe coding versus traditional coding. You know, people often work in sprints in an agile methodology, and it still might be slower, like weeks or months for similar outcomes. Accessibility. Vibe coding's very beginner-friendly. There's low barriers to entry. Traditional coding, you know, requires deep technical knowledge for good reason. You know, control. AI handles most logic and user guides and reviews, and it will do these things, whereas traditional coding will give you full control over every aspect of code. So, for example, if you just want to see something done, there's a million ways you could do it. But if you wanted it done efficiently, you probably need to know code inside out to be able to cut down and do it in the most efficient way. And programmers are delightful when they're talking about elegance in code. You know, it's a real thing. You know, is that a beautiful way to solve the problem? Is it efficient? And efficient code takes less processing power. You know, so there are real outcomes to being great at that. But, you know, vibe coding could be great for prototypes, for minimum viable products, for tiny apps, for quick experiments, whereas traditional coding is great for everything, like large, complex, mission-critical systems, anything super important, that sort of thing. Customization, vibe coding, you know, I think you guys have all experimented a little bit with some of the generative large language models. They're limited by the AI's capabilities, and if you're trying to make discrete changes to something, let's say the image generation ones, if you go, oh, I like all of this, but can you change that? You'll know that it's very difficult to just change one aspect of this. The system will look at everything and it'll spit something back out, and you go, oh, well, I like this better. You change, you know, this part of the image to red, but you changed all these other things too, and you know, so you've got a lot less fine-grained control to customize things, whereas traditional coding, unlimited capability. Developers can fine-tune everything, and they do.
Is it kind of like Wikipedia? Like, maybe it's like a jumping in point, but if you want to get deeper,
You got to go full journals. It's not a bad analogy, Jace. And this is good. This is giving me hope that I'm hopefully we're getting there. Maintenance. All right. If you're putting something into one of these systems, it's not really designed to be maintained, particularly if the person putting the requests in doesn't understand the code anyway. So if you're getting something generated to you and you don't have the skills to critically analyze it, to assess what it's doing, and then to fix it, to change it yourself, there's going to be clear barriers there. But, you know, maintenance, in something that's really planned out will be a lot easier. The developer will, or the team, will understand all of the different code decisions and can go back and, you know, verify this is why we did this this way, this is the user feedback we heard, this is what we're trying to achieve. Mm. Cost might be hugely significant here. Mm. The lower upfront cost to just throw something together and see if it works and see if this is what people had in mind, like, that's kind of powerful. But, you know, the cost for a fully fledged bit of software development, it's huge. Mm. Yeah.
So who is it, professionally, who's it a threat to? Just bad coders?
Yeah.
Like, is AI a threat in the IT world just to mediocrity? Whereas if you're excellent, it can't touch you?
I don't see it quite that way. I don't think it's a threat to mediocrity. I think that we really need to think about the scope and what it's good for.
Mm.
I am loath to throw out helpful tools, but I really would love people to understand where the usefulness ends
mm.
and where the rigor has to be brought in. Because if you've got anything serious, depending on your software solving a problem, then it really needs to be validated. There's a reason that there are professional capabilities built around this stuff. That said, look, it's kind of exciting to see what can happen. Now, this is vibe coding alone, and I thought it was a hilarious, you know, idea, and people make jokes about it. And often when you hear people talking about it and the vibes and what have you, I'm obviously in a very technical, you know, social kind of world where people have made a lot of fun of it. But that accessibility piece, that idea that you might empower people and maybe some of them get a bit more curious about how can I do this better? What would access to this do? What would unlocking solutions mean? And maybe they can just explain what they need to a software developer better after playing with a tool like this. That's pretty powerful. That's kind of amazing.
That's big translation.
Isn't
it's
it?
Yeah. So tricky.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Like a bit of a baptism by fire. They might use AI to try and solve all their problems and then realise, like, all the different threads that can unravel.
Yeah. And it is, I mean, it speaks to a democratisation of this sort of space. And I think that when you talk about threat, I think that's the bit that people can find threatening. But we should flip it. Instead of it being a negative reaction and people being threatened by this, it should be about risk mitigation. It should be about the opportunity to educate and help and step in when you see this happening. Mm. But really, isn't it kind of good to democratize knowledge, you know, to help people along this journey and help them solve problems with code instead of this being some arcane knowledge, and let's not be, you know, gatekeeping about it. Yeah. So there you go.
Web surfing and vibe coding really were the worst two Beach Boys B-sides.
Rest in peace, Brian.
Thanks so much. Catch you on Bite Into It.
Yep, look forward to it. Cheers.
Triple R on FM, digital, online and via the app.
With all the craziness that has been happening in the news, you would be forgiven for potentially missing the story that Australian music legend Joe Camilleri, the frontman of the Black Sorrows, who was in the news, I saw it yesterday, maybe the last 2 days, had 9 of his guitars stolen from his house. Yes, saw this, which absolutely sucks, as if there's not enough challenges facing musicians and the creative world anyway. But the story stood out as well because the other items that were also taken from his home last week, which, caught my attention, and I'm sure many others. So they stole up to 9 guitars, which has been alerted in the details out there. So you can't really move them, can you? They'd be tricky to resell.
They're not going anywhere unless you're just a diehard and wants to play them at home by yourself.
Well, and then again, so what do you make of the rest of the items that were taken? They took all his cutlery, some bathroom products, a leaf blower, and a green wheelie bin with the yellow lid, the one with the yellow lid. So that's recycling. And I'm just struck by such a peculiar mix of items, and it could either be that they knew exactly what they wanted. Mm. They went like, no, they had a list to check off, or it was like impulse shopping, in which I feel like potentially a lot of burglaries are, not to glorify them.
We do need a recycling bin, don't we? Yeah, grab the recycling bin.
Yeah, no, grab the bin. The cutlery gets me.
That's screaming junkies to me.
All the cog. Hey, wow, that is so dark. I was thinking dinner party, or maybe they play the spoons. I was thinking musical circles, but there you go. He's done it. He's gone straight to the hard drugs. No, don't apologise. We're here to crack the case.
I can't think of too many things you want cutlery for.
But the whole set.
Yeah, all right.
They took all of it. Or let's assume they took all of it.
Let's have a dinner party, play some guitars and...
So, a music circle cutlery set, I'm thinking the wheelie bin transports it, and then leaf blower, I don't know, maybe some kind of background noise to create some atmosphere in a track. I'm not sure. I don't know. Interesting.
Mm.
And to go for the top drawer as well.
Mm.
Or then it's just a snatch and grab.
Mm. I reckon. So it was a house in the country, is that right?
Yep, in Central Vic.
So do you reckon maybe they've gone one? Maybe they could have gone back a couple of times. Who knows?
Okay. Yeah.
Got the guitars. Got back home. Oh, we do need a leaf blower.
I forgot that. Yeah, and the cheese knife. Get the cheese knife.
It's a bloody leaf blower back at Joe Camilleri's. Let's go get that.
Let's go grab that. Get the rake. No, leave the rake. That would be rude. I don't want to leave him without a rake. Let's take all the guitars, part of musical history, but please leave the rake and the potty mix.
I'm pretty sure he donated a guitar to Triple R to raise money for Radiothon.
Oh. Was that quite a few years back?
Yeah.
I think I remember that as well.
But 9 is a lot.
It's a lot.
It's funny, I've seen Steve Smith, the Australian cricketer, he can be blindfolded and be handed maybe up to, look, I don't want to over-egg it, but let's say 13 cricket bats, and he can hold them and know which one it is.
Wow.
And identify it just from his stance holding the bat.
Closing the eyes.
Yeah. Wow. And I wonder, a guitarist like that with, because I think of Pete Townsend just smashing his guitars and how he couldn't possibly get too attached to them.
Mm.
Nine's a lot, isn't it? What a gun.
Well, I guess like cricket bats, they all have their special feeling, the thing that they bring to a certain track.
Yes. Yep.
A certain bat, if you're just about to crack the ton.
Yeah, but and are they, because I don't handle a lot of music instruments, are they heavy?
You're lugging. Lugging gear. It's not...
You're right, you do lug gear. It's like how you get bundled out of a tournament. You lug gear.
You lug it in and out of the van room.
Lug your emotions.
Yeah. Lugging a good gig, a bad gig. Yeah.
But it's also, cutlery so noisy.
Yes.
Like, you're going to get busted.
It's hard to be discreet.
Oh, just imagine that, electric guitars and cutlery.
And cutlery. And it's like...
Chuck in the leaf blower, make it real noisy.
How inconvenient.
I know, it's like, and surely, if you're pulling open the drawers, as if you're not going the second or the third down, and then the fourth. You know, what's in the fourth drawer? You know, we know the second or the third is all the fun stuff, the tongs, the peelers, the flippers, the wooden spoons. Would you agree? Is that second or third for you?
I'd say it's almost second.
Okay, second.
Yeah.
And then the fourth is manuals, tea towels, batteries, you're going to sticky tape and take to be recycled. I understand now, actually, saying that out loud, why you didn't go for the fourth drawer.
Which I imagine that, Joe Camilleri would have some cracking tea towels. Probably have like an old Nick Cave one.
Yeah.
Old.
That'd all have a story, wouldn't they? And some excellent magnets.
Aussie Crawl. He'd have some Aussie Crawl ones.
Okay, well, they've really missed an opportunity. So if they're listening.
Unless it's melted, unless cutlery, you're melting it down or something. But if you're taking your wheelie binners, maybe they took the cutlery to fill the wheelie bin.
Yeah.
The wheelie bin shows you how, if there was a reason to steal the wheelie bin, because you worked for council now, is it quite hard to get a second bin?
Big time.
Right.
They are a prized possession, and there is a lot of accusations thrown around about people harbouring second wheelie bins and how they come into possession with them. So, yeah, I hadn't even thought of that. They're absolutely hot property.
Wow. Like, it should come with a birth certificate.
Yeah, they should.
Like if a neighbour says, where'd you get your bin?
Oh, yeah, the serial number.
Yes.
Well, they do. They do come with a serial number and are assigned to an address, so things can really heat up between neighbours. But, of course, they always go missing. Like, you know, sometimes all the bins are all akimbo all over the street when you go to bring it in the morning. Would you agree?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
So you can accidentally trade it in. That's why you got to put a sticker on it. Put your triple R sticker on
it. Get the triple R sticker on the bin. One great of identifier. Many.
Anyway, so, but I was thinking as well, I mean, yeah, I'm always struck by like just a bit of an odd robbery as well. And I was having a look at one. There was one from last year as well where someone went into a milk bar and they had a super soaker and just demanded, they only wanted one thing. It was just a can of Red Bull. And they were like, just, no, I'm not going to pay for it. And just held the super, which I'm sure it would be incredibly stressful for the person working in the milk bar. But it's, it's an interesting choice, isn't it? Doesn't do anything good for the image of energy drinks.
No.
A friend is overseas at the moment and they sent me a picture of their Airbnb and there is just a slab of Mother energy drinks gross. In the fridge and then two slabs in the corner.
Whoa.
And I'm like, that is scarier than finding a knife under a bed. Like, that's terrifying to me.
It's funny that drink's named after something that would cause probably prenatal injury to a child. It's called Mother. But the sort of text line says, you know, it's a disgruntled neighbour, potentially. And with the leaf blower, it makes me wonder, does Joe Clement live next to Cate Blanchett?
It's all coming together
she
now.
She famously hates leaf blowers.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
She's been quoted in so many interviews just letting rip on leaf blowers.
Well, I'm kind of with her. They're so annoying. They use up heaps of energy, so noisy. I wonder if Cate Blanchett lives around Merri Creek. I did see someone's thrown a leaf blower.
Oh, really? She's a vigilante. Our Kate's gone rogue.
Well, maybe, yeah, leaf blowers. The group against leaf blowers have united, and this is all connected, the Merri Creek and Joe Camilleri. Anyway, all the best to the burglar and whatever dinner party or vigilante act this was.
Yeah, send us some pics.
Yeah.
I'd love to.
Just return the guitars.
At least half of them.
At least four.
Give four back. They're sentimental. So many memories.
Woo!
That's right. Triple R.
Mark Brandy is the best-selling author of novels Wimmera, The Rip, The Others and Southern Aurora, winning along the way the British Crime Writers Association Debut Dagger, Best Debut at the Australian Indie Book Awards, a high commendation in the 2024 Victorian Premier's Literary Awards and being shortlisted for the Australian Book Industry Awards Literary Fiction Book of the Year. Mark's new thriller is Eden, which explores how we all have secrets, though some are deadlier than others. And to tell us about it, one of Australia's foremost purveyors of literary dread joins us now. Mark, welcome to Breakfasters.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, every crime writer we speak to is absolutely delightful.
Yeah. What's going on?
I think we get it out all on the page. Yeah. So then we travel quite lightly after that. But it's a good crowd, actually. Most crime writers are good fun. Mm-hmm. I'm probably the exception.
Now, is there a through line that you've noticed as Eden came to fruition through all your other work?
Yeah, look, all my books are probably focused on people on the margins of society, and Eden is no different. It's the story of a guy named Tom Blackburn who's just gotten out of jail after a long stretch inside. And like a lot of ex-prisoners, he really struggles to really rebuild his life in the outside world. And complicating matters further is this secret from his past which re-emerges and really forces him into a moral dilemma.
Mm. Is it harder to keep secrets these days?
I think with the online world, very much so. I mean, in Tom's case, he actually changes his name while he's in prison. He's just really wanting to make a clean break. I think, you know, in that sense, it's a bit of a universal story because we all have secrets. We all have regrets from our past. And in Tom's case, it's just that little bit more precarious because of the situation he finds himself in with, you know, no money, no job, no connections on the outside.
Mm. What do you think of readers and maybe television watchers' inherent interest and empathy in outsider characters and maybe in resolute indifference in real life?
Yeah, well, it's interesting, isn't it? I think there's probably a little bit of kind of vicarious experience that goes on in crime writing and crime reading and also in watching that sort of stuff. People like to have the experience of seeing what it's like to be on the margins, to, you know, live a criminal life or fight crime and the other side of it. And it's, you know, I think sometimes people get caught up in their own world and in their own technology. If you're walking down the street, people staring at their phones and they're not really taking notice of what's going on around them. And there's so many people in our society, I think, who live really close to the edge, and it only really takes one or two things going wrong and they can end up in jail, you know. And so that's where my kind of interest lies, and I suppose I like exploring that world. You know, I'm not a crusader in my writing. It's not like I want to change the world or change people so much. I want people to enjoy the stories. But my biggest hope for it is that people have that experience of walking in other people's shoes and maybe after reading a book, go out into the street and look at things a little bit differently. I know with my second book, The Rip, which focused on the experience of a homeless person on the streets of Melbourne, I had people contact me afterwards going, oh, you know, after reading your book, there's a beggar down the end of my street and I got to talking to him and it's really like changed the way I view others. And, you know, that's magic for me. I just love it when that happens. But I don't expect it either because I think that reading is different for everyone. For some people, it's just a little bit of an escape. In my case, it's probably a bit of an escape into a darker world. So I hope people take something more from it.
What about your process when it comes to, you know, you talk about walking in other people's shoes. How do you do that? And I guess, yeah, what's your creative process when writing these characters?
Yeah, it's a bit of a strange one. I spend a lot of time, like I don't plan my books in any way. I'm a little bit different from some other writers in that respect. I spend a lot of time kind of thinking about character, and so I start with character always. And in the case of Tom in Eden, he was a character, it's probably a little bit of a spoiler, but he's a character from one of my earlier books. And so I had sort of an idea of what he was like and what kind of things that he'd been through. And really plot follows from character for me. I kind of want the story to be in service of the character and not the reverse. And I think, like, some crime fiction can be very plot-driven and focus on, you know, the whodunit aspects of the story, and my books aren't really like that. So when I start to write, I start with character and I really become immersed in that world. I'm working on it every day, and that can be quite heavy because I'm walking in the shoes of these you know, characters who are really struggling in life. But I love it, you know. It's a real, like, escape for me. It's like the magic of the experience of writing is what keeps me going. It's not, you know, awards or good reviews or anything like that, but it's being inside that world, being in flow, you know. The rest of my life just disappears, time disappears. So it's, yeah, I feel very lucky to be doing that.
What an incredible escape to have. That's amazing.
Do you ever creep yourself out in the process of writing?
Yeah. Well, you know, in my family, I've got, like, my three older brothers all work in sort of law enforcement in different ways. One's a forensic scientist. Another, he's a prosecutor with Victoria Police. Another works in criminal records for Victoria Police. My partner works at the county court. So I've kind of been immersed in these really, like, heavy, dark stories. So nothing really frightens me that much. In saying that, like, I sometimes feel bad putting my characters in such peril as well, because they start to become very real to you. You know, I feel like I can see them, I understand them. It sounds crazy, but they're like a part of me and a part of my life. So I wouldn't say I creep myself out, but I do feel a bit of remorse sometimes for the situations I put them in.
Does your own background in the justice system, how do you conceive of that, and how might that differ from the way other people project that onto you?
You know, my experience working in the justice system, I went into it like I wanted to make a difference. I wanted to do something positive for the community and for people who were struggling. And what I saw, particularly in the corrections portfolio, because I worked as a political advisor for a few years to the corrections minister, what I saw was that you essentially had the same cohort cycling through jail again and again and again. You had the poor, people who had mental health problems, people had substance abuse issues. The recidivism rate was pretty much stuck at 40%. So 2 out of 5 prisoners end up back in jail within 5 years. And I think that the justice system does its best, like in a rehabilitation sense, but they're really broad and complex social issues that are behind why people get in contact with the justice system. So, you know, I sometimes get asked about my experience, and I think, you know, people want sort of stories and, you know, like some of the visits I had to the prisons and some of the people that I encountered there. And there's a little bit of a salacious aspect to that, but I don't conceive of my experience in that way. I found it quite an eye-opening experience, and it really alerted me to those deeper sort of social issues, and that's what concerns me as a writer.
Mm. And I suppose Eden explores second chances, and it's interesting, the cultural conversations around rehabilitation, second chances, or, the idea of redemption seems an ongoing conversation.
Yeah. I think there's, in some people at least, a sense that you kind of have to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps, and if you can make some changes in your life, that you can improve things. But I feel as though, you know, life's not really like that. We're all the product of our experiences, of our genetics, of all these really complex factors. You need a bit of luck, you know, basically to turn your life around when things go wrong. You need to have the right people around you to support you in that as well. And if you're, say, leaving prison and going back into the same environment, you've lost a lot of social connections. Maybe some family members feel burnt and don't want to be in touch with you anymore. Like a lot of the people who you knew who were perhaps law-abiding people may not want to have contact with you anymore. So it becomes really, really difficult. I love the idea of second chances. I love the idea that people can turn their life around. But I think as a society, we have to do better to try to help people into that situation.
Mm. What about geography and the city? Does that, as a writer, how does that energise you as opposed to setting something in the, you know, in the country or the bush?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a sort of country crime writing in Australia is a really rich vein. There's a lot of books set in the country. I've now, you know, set a couple of my books in the city, and I think, like, Melbourne, I love Melbourne. I'm from the country originally. I grew up in Stawell in Western Victoria, but the thing I loved about coming to Melbourne is the kind of anonymity that you have in a country town. You know, everyone knows who you are. Everyone knows everything that you've done. You come to Melbourne, it's like a clean slate. But I think the flip side of that is that it can be a really lonely place too, even though you're surrounded by people. A city can be very, very lonely and very isolating. And so when I came to write Tom's character, who, you know, not unlike me, he's from the country originally, I really wanted to convey some of that loneliness that he experiences. So, yeah, and you know, the book is set in the Melbourne General Cemetery, and so which is a place just a couple of streets from my house. So I really loved writing about that as well. I'm probably a bit lazy in that I like writing about places just close by.
A crime writer lives near cemetery.
Yeah. Can see it out his window.
Well, we got through the whole chat without giving too much away. That's pretty cool.
It's hard.
The only spoiler was from you. So.
I know.
Mark Brandy's new book is Eden. Congratulations. And it's out via Hachette in bookshops now, and we really appreciate you coming in this morning.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Triple R.
Here with his signature understated ebullience. It's the very funny Friday funny bugger, Oliver Coleman. Morning, Oliver.
Ebullient as ever. Good to be here.
What's ebullient?
You know what, Natalie? I believe that it... What does it mean?
Relentlessly cheerful, I suppose.
Yeah. I was going to say overflowing with joy.
Yeah.
And if there's one word to describe myself that is indented on my business card, it is ebullient. Good to be here. Mm. Thank you so much. Yeah, I am feeling somewhat ebullient. Well, am I? I don't know. I'm certainly trying. You know, it's the depths of winter. It's cold. It's rainy. So you know, it might sound a little gauche, but I am trying at the moment to focus on things that bring me joy.
Yuck! No. I'm It's like a parent asking you, what was the best part of your day? No,
I'm All right. Well, I'll see, Natalie, if a few things on my list cannot warm your cold, dead heart.
Yeah, okay.
What's first on my list? Mashed potato. That one's obvious.
Oh, yum.
Yum.
Melted already.
We all like mashed potato. Cordial. That's another one. So I had some people over for my house at for dinner the other week, and someone brought, you know, nobody's drinking anymore. So someone brought a bottle of Ribena and left that at my house, and I was just going hog wild. That's
shocking
on that.
For your teeth, eh?
Shocking for your teeth, but that's why I like it, because I think like you can just have water, but then when you just give over shamelessly and guiltlessly to drinking cordial, there's nothing's better. And once the bottle of Ribena was finished, I just fell into that kind of childhood pleasure zone, and I went and bought myself a bottle of lime cooler.
Yeah, good.
Which is that one, the fluorescent green freaky one, which is just...
You regressed.
I regressed.
Whoa.
I'm becoming my worst self.
I don't think water touched my lips as a child. Everything had cordial. And I think that would be one of my secret skills. Like, I can free pour the perfect, like, amount of cordial into a cup, and it's the perfect strength.
Oh, the old free pour.
You were one of those fancy kids. You were like those cocktails. You were doing flares and that sort of thing with the cordial bottle.
We had, like, over a litre jug, and just the artistry that go in, just the wrist knew how much cordial needed to go in that jug.
Yes. And I feel sorry for the current generation of kids. They're probably not getting that free flow of sugar into their gullet like we were.
Getting cucumber in water or...
Yeah. Or something. Yeah, they're probably starting their day with lemon water.
Yeah, or elderberry or elderflower.
Come on, kids, have your apple cider vinegar shot.
Yeah, yeah.
Get that digestion going. The cordial, that's what the TV show Landline. I feel like, do you watch that? That's
It's a great show.
Yeah. I feel like I don't watch a lot of terrestrial television, but if that show is on when I'm flicking on the TV, I'm not switching off Landline.
I don't seek it out, but when it's on, yeah, I'm with you.
Don't you? You're just hooked on that agricultural news.
Exactly. Chuck on the Cobra. Fill us in a little bit.
Well, obviously, you know, you get your standard kind of, you're getting your beef, your sheep, your goat prices and that sort of thing. You cross the board, they'll be covering the drought somewhere.
Yeah.
But the best parts are when they're doing some sort of niche segment on like a black sapote farm outside of Broome, or like they're looking at the new kind of, you know, sea cucumber aquaculture set up outside of Cooktown. Cool. That's when I'm really hooked.
If the ABC's funding is ever threatened, Landline's the sort of show. It's like, Landline!
That's the thing, do not touch ads. I know. I mean, I'm like, yes, cut the ads, fuzzy. Sure, get rid of Q&A.
Don't touch the big ag.
You dare touch Landline with its 8,000 viewers every Sunday. No, that is, it's just a stunning show. And there's nothing I love more than some sort of, like, recently graduated Bachelor of Journalism student outside from, like, you know, Charles Sturt University wearing a fake, you know, Stetson hat, a Kubra reporting from the desert.
Just shiny R.M. Williams.
Trying to act calm around a bull. That's my favourite thing. Landline. What else have I been enjoying? Living with my girlfriend. That's been really nice.
That's beautiful.
She's recently moved in. And she's there's so many. It's just for fun. It's just fun and funny having someone.
It's just fun. It's fun. What a sign of commitment.
How long into the living scenario are you in?
We're about 2 months in now.
Okay, that's good.
It's nice because it just means there's another person there.
Yeah.
It sounds like I could be living with anyone. So fun things. The other night I was making curry.
Yeah.
And I had like some frozen beans on my cutting board, and then I also have this bag of frozen, like, little green Indian chilies, and I had two of them there as well. And I left the room, and I came back, and I looked at the cutting board, and I was like, didn't I get two chilies out of the bag? And my girlfriend goes, I ate one.
What?
And then tears suddenly started streaming down her face. She thought one was a bean. So she ate this whole chili.
Pay for itself.
I thought it was like a joke that she'd done it. She just like a trick.
She thought I tricked her.
Penny.
And then so she's spooning yogurt into her
mouth.
I've never.
That's brutal.
She did. And she did. She did vomit.
We should enter into the chili eating contest. We'll find out the date.
Yeah, and she's not good with spice.
Oh, well, she's now.
Just tell her it's beans.
Yeah.
She'll win the joys of living with a girlfriend.
It's the best.
Chili eating girlfriend.
Yeah. And it's nice to be in love. That's
awesome. But also what a treat to have someone you love crying, and it's not the result of an argument.
And it's not my fault. I was like, I didn't know this could happen.
We've had tears.
Oh, yeah. And the solution is simple as dairy.
I don't need to go to therapy for this lesson.
No. I don't need a mental health lab for this.
It's amazing. What else have I got? You used the word ebullient.
Yeah.
What a beautiful word.
Mm.
I've been loving. I'm trying to reduce my screen time at the moment.
Okay.
And so one way I've done that, because I write for comedy and stuff, I try and I bought a paper thesaurus, like a book thesaurus, so that when I have to look up a word, I can just go to that instead. And it's so... it brings you joy.
Does
to
it?
Flick through
does
a
it really?
Book of words. It does.
Okay, yeah.
And you know why it's better? Because, like, the other day I was flicking through, you notice the other words on the page.
Mm.
Like, the other day I was going to use the word obtuse. And I was like, is this the right word? Maybe there's another word. But then I was just flicking, and then I landed in the U's, and I saw the word unorthodox, and I was like, actually... unorthodox is actually the word I think is more appropriate here. And I wouldn't have got that if I was 100% using thesaurus on the internet.
Same with a dictionary. Go to a dictionary, find a definition, then look at words around it, you'll learn something.
Yeah, don't you? And it's just nice to hold the thing in your hands.
You don't miss the, like, flashy moving things all over the screen?
The pop-ups and the...
Yeah, the ads.
No.
What about the ads?
No, look, flashy things, I go to the Pokies and I do that 8 hours every day.
That's where I get my screen time. Uninterrupted. 8 hours I go from 9 till sunrise.
It's true. I've blocked all the ads on my phone.
I don't answer my phone. I don't take it.
No way, but Pokies is fine.
My girlfriend's at home. She feeds the dog.
Yes, another thing on my list that brings me joy, credit card debt. So that's all.
Wow.
The Pokies is working for that. What? Noticing other people's joy. That's one that's... So your lips curl.
I know.
Natalie Harris.
What have you noticed?
The other day I was walking down the street. It was a particularly warm day. And these two, they would have been like four or five little boys, were lying on the concrete facing each other, and they were like pressing their cheeks into like the warm concrete, and they were saying excitedly to each other, "It's warm.
Oh, that's cute.
It's warm."
Like little lizards.
That's lovely.
They did have scales. I thought that was really beautiful.
I feel like I'm watching a short film at MIF hearing about this.
I know. I have all of this. I've just kind of.
Did you miss the days when they used fried egg on centre court?
I miss those beautiful days. Mm. Yeah. Can they not do that anymore? Have they changed the surface?
Well, maybe it's not. Maybe with the heat stroke and the climate, it's less fun or something.
Yes.
But yeah. Yeah,
it used to be a novelty. Now it's like,
it's a harvest.
It's bad. We've got enough eggs.
Yeah. And really, they can just fry them every day now. It's not a novelty.
Well, they could give those sack lines people a gig.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Come out with some eggs and bacon and do a cook-up.
Halftime show.
Yeah, I want to. Yeah, I'm sick of these tennis players eating bananas and that sort of thing. They should have to play. If you're going longer than four sets, you should have to eat a full English just to give like a real level of tension to that fifth set. That's my dream.
All right. Are we out of joy?
My last one was I saw the guy behind the counter at 7-Eleven buying a pinata on his phone.
That's good.
What?
That was really fun.
Yeah.
Joy to come.
What was the nature of the pinata? Was it like a log or was it in the shape?
No, it was the classic donkey shape.
Sweet.
Yeah. Which is, you know, if you're going to pick a pinata, I think go the classic donkey.
Yeah. They're pretty resilient, those donkeys.
They are, aren't they? Mm. I always found it wild, the pinata game. Let's blindfold someone and then let
that's
them
why
go with
the that's
stick.
Why I put a nail at the end of the stick so it can pierce it properly.
Get to those lollies faster.
I love it. Where can we see you? What do you want us to do?
You can see me this very evening.
Yay!
Yeah, at Comedy Republic's Replay Festival. My show, The Ballad of Oliver Common, is playing there 7:30 p.m. tonight. Go to the Comedy Republic website for tickets.
Beautiful. Oliver Common at Comedy Republic. Good on you and see you again soon.
Thanks so much.
Melbourne's own Triple R.
Thanks for listening to a podcast of the Best Bits of Breakfasters, the Monday to Friday breakfast show broadcast live on Triple R from Melbourne, Australia. Feel free to get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or via the Triple R website.